tried to promote a revival of Hippolytus' religion on behalf of the empire, the logical step was emperor worship. You see, the idea that the emperor ruled on behalf of the gods was an old idea. The idea that the emperor was the gods was a new idea in the West, not an idea in the East. This idea of emperor worship came from Alexander the Great. He got from the Persian. You see, the ancient Near Eastern people, Mesopotamian people, they worked out very early the scheme that the king was the son of the god. The king somehow was invested with deity. He represented the gods. He was a god. He was worshipped as a god. In ancient Persia, they worshipped as a god. Alexander, when he left Macedonia, he was a general. The Greeks, by the way, had nothing to do with this. The Greeks, you know, their golden age was the age of Pericles, the age of democracy, the theory of Lingu. The Greeks had the concept, which was so revolutionary in our own history, that the right to govern rose from the governed. It was not sent down from heaven. So Alexander the Great got into the East, and he saw how the wealthy was treated there. He liked it. He dressed himself up in Persian robes and had himself addressed as a god. He went to Persia and he said, "I'm a god." And they said, "It's obvious you are. Nobody could do the things you do except to be a god. You conquered the world and obviously was a god." He went to Egypt and said, "I'm a god." And they had a long tradition of the same thing, and they said, "Yeah, obviously you're a god, and hello, Mr. God." He sent word back home to Macedonia, "Guess what? I'm a god." And they said, quote, "Crazy old Alex is at it again." Now, who's he think he is? It's one of the reasons that he never went back home, because they laughed at the very idea of him being a god. The Greeks knew better. And the Romans knew better. They had the Republic. They had the Senate. And remember Cincinnatus, who left his plow and saved Rome and then went back to his plowing? That's their concept of a leader. Kind of like, and by the way, that's sort of our concept, isn't it? You know, that the president is not above the law. We had a bitter reminder of that in the last decade. So this Eastern idea was brought back to the West, the influence of Alexander the Great. Remember at times the 50s, 160 years before Christ, had himself declared God, and it caused and ultimately it led to the Maccabean revolt.
I'm just wondering if that idea is still around today.
At this period of time, when they worship all the gods for the different reasons, like you say, crops and whatever, we've seen that period of history where there's ignorance, where they haven't, education is really the love. Is this the same period where the people go ahead and believe in these gods, maybe as like wives' tales and things like this, that this will happen, that will happen, at that period of time?
Hard to say what people believe. Yeah. Many people took it seriously. I'm simply saying by its very nature, it would not qualify as religion as we would define it.
Would it be more like a busy work and entertainment, things to do?
Well, it's a matter of survival, you know. Again, old wives' tales are a part of lower cultures. Sometimes it's connected with education, sometimes it isn't. The only people in the world that I've done business with who read directly or indirectly, who see the principle of belief, who would look at matter, you know, trees or material world, attribute deity to it, or the attributes of deity, or like in New Guinea, it's the Bushmen in the back areas of Australia, and the natives in the jungles of New Guinea, and the evolutionists at the university campus. They're the only ones who really look at dead matter and attribute life to it. But that's one of them.
So this idea that Caesar was a god was rejected. Julius Caesar realized that this was a good idea. That you see, if you could create the myth. Now keep in mind that Julius Caesar was
trying to pull things back together. And he had seen, or he knew from his reading, from his experience, that this idea that your ruler is a god is a very convenient political idea. Creates unity, obedience, you see. And so, with Julius Caesar began to be created the myth that Augustus exploited, and that was that Caesar was a god, that the ruler of Rome was the city of God, eternal Rome, that the rule of the Caesars was the rule of heaven. To revolt against the Caesar was to revolt against the gods himself. And so Julius Caesar had himself declared Jupiter Julius by the Senate. He said to the Senate, "I want you to vote me a god." So they voted Julius a god. Now, why did they do that? Because they thought he was a god? No, because he had an army and they didn't. What do you call a man who has an army when you don't have an army? Anything he wasn't a god. And so he was a god. Now, however, to show you, but it's interesting that there was a committee made up of Brutus and Cassius and a few others who didn't accept that decision, so they murdered their god. They assassinated him. Well, his grandnephew, Augustus, we're talking about, he picked up on this idea, and he had himself declared the son of God. But this time, he managed to survive long enough that the people would begin to believe it or accept it. They would accept the idea, which is not necessarily the same thing as believing it. You can make that distinction in your mind. We can't really do that. They accepted the idea without believing it, and said, we believe that Jesus is the Son of God. For one reason they believed it was, he was having a great deal of success. He had won most of his battles, won all the important ones, and things were working again. He had done a great job of pulling the empire together. And therefore, I think historians agree that Augustus did not consider himself to be a god. But he realized that this idea would help to unify the empire, so he promoted it. Now later, some of the emperors did believe they were gods. Or we think they did. Again, you can't be sure. What they believed, we say they're gods. They didn't necessarily believe that they were gods while they were on earth. They were sort of the representative of God on earth, but as soon as they died, they would immediately join the Olympian crowd and be an apotheosis to become God. It's hard to know exactly the content of some of this faith because of the apostate material. But anyway, it's interesting, Claudius. Later on, Claudius is the emperor who must be much superior to the book of Acts. Claudius was murdered by his wife, and she fed him poisoned mushrooms. And Nero later on said, mushrooms must be the food of the gods. As soon as you eat them, you become one. So from that kind of talk, it's difficult to know exactly what they believe, but it was a convenient political myth. You got that? Asked about the people believe, it's hard to say. When they said Caesar, well, how many really believed he was a god? Well, I don't know. And they didn't really care as long as you say so. As long as you say so. It's an oath of allegiance. Now this became very important to the Christians. Because many Christians died because they would not say so. You must say Caesar is Lord. No. He's not a Lord. I don't care. That's nothing to do with it. You must say so. Say that he is. And, well, anyway, any questions out there? Did I go too far past your question?
I just wondered if they thought that their gods were above death, and if so, how did they explain the death of their rulers?
Well, that was the point I was making. They say they were gods, you know, standing there in their boots. They didn't necessarily still die, but they were dead, and as soon as they died, they became gods. They joined Zeus as part of that. The happy clan supporting around Mount Olympus. You know, eating nectar and sipping ambrosia. Making whoopee. Dave?
If they didn't really care whether they believed they were God, then what would be the advantage of having them say so?
That's a good question. The advantage was that an expression of national or imperial solidarity. It was like a pledge of allegiance. It was like a first every soldier you join the army, you take an oath that uphold the Constitution. Now, did they take you into the back room after you made that oath and sit down and say, "Did you really believe it?" I suppose that out of every million men who have took the oath to uphold the Constitution, there's probably not three that ever read the Constitution. You know, I don't know what it says or what it is, but I'm for it. It's the same kind of thing of, now by the way, in modern times, the only clear instance that we have of this, is a strange mentality. You almost had it with the Mao Zedong cult in China, but not quite. You did have it, and you did have direct emperor worship in Japan in the 1930s and 40s. The kamikaze pilot who would take his oath and blast to death, suicide, this kind of devotion. But it's hard for us to really believe. But it was how could the people, how could so many people really, you know, say Caesar was Lord and believe that, you know, the Senate could vote the man into heaven, right, as a part of the God family? Well, good understand that they didn't have that. You see, when we think of this, when we think of, you know, this average Roman who is told that their Caesar is now no longer, that he's a god. Got that? He represents the rule of heaven. When we think of that, we compare this idea with Christianity. And of course, what do? We reject it. We laugh it out of court forthwith because of our point of comparison. You understand? Those people didn't have that. But that idea was just about as good as any other idea they had. And it fit in with their, there was nothing in their mythology that would forbid that. And he was sure doing a great thing. And he couldn't be any worse than some of the gods they were worshiping. Could he? Why not? You got that? Didn't have anything better? Wasn't there really a strong reason not to believe it? Why not? Make him happy? Make me happy. Who cares? That is true. That is true. I mean, which is not, you see, this is why the church, only the Christians, saw that this was profoundly unacceptable. But only when they heard the gospel. Once they heard the gospel, then this kind of thinking became totally absurd. And they rejected it. But only after they had this point, only after they had heard the gospel. Now, So this average Roman hears the announcement that Augustus is God, Caesar is Lord, and he accepts it. His accepting of it, for the reasons that I gave, does not constitute a profound religious conversion, does it? You can see that, I think. Yes.
Is this idea kind of in the Catholic Church today, religion, Pope, same type of
same mentality? In many cases, yes. More in Europe and South America than in America. For instance, you see this mentality, but not so much in America, but in Europe and South America. Remember when they purged the saints on the calendar, they purged the calendar, and found out that some of the saints not only were not saints, but never even existed? The interesting thing, but you see, very interesting thing, so when Rome announced this, they said to the people, "Honestly, we must tell you that, as far as our historical investigations show, that these following saints have never lived." Okay? So then, and they gave their name. But they said, "You must not think that you must stop praying to them. You know, this does not mean that you will not continue to pray to them." So the important thing is not whether they lived or not, the important thing is what they represent. You buy that? But you see, especially in Europe and South America, there are thousands and thousands of people who are praying the same. They've already been told that they never existed. Well, what difference does that make? The idea is, well, I'll just go and pray to that saint, just in case. And if that saint doesn't exist, the Virgin Mary will make it all right anyway. She takes all undirected phone calls. But you see that? In other words,
this is the same mentality. God, there's no necessary connection between reality and what you believe. Again, this is kind of like existentialist too. But you see, one of the reasons that Christianity, perhaps I'd occasion to say this again, but one of the reasons Christianity spread so rapidly was not only that it was intellectually respectable, but that it was set in history. You see, all they had was this empty, intellectually sterile, morally corrupt system with Caesar at the head of it. The whole thing was very, very unsatisfactory, and for all kinds of reasons. But now you had, and where were their gods? Could you see their gods? You see, it was once upon a time in a land far away. But with Jesus, you had a God who came among men. He was set in time and history. He was here. We saw him. He rose from the dead on this day, in this place. We saw him. If you had been there, you would have seen him. The fact of it, and so this was, see how he's calling it? It was real. Real. And this is one of the many reasons that Christianity took the Roman Empire in one generation. Because when they heard this, it was like finding a spring in the desert. Well, you could hang your hat on it. This was something so much better. Okay, tomorrow we're going to talk about the mystery of this and we'll move on to the next section. But, I hope that you have understood that the gospel came into the world, it came into a, what I call a spiritual backdrop. One of the reasons that it took the Roman world in one generation was that various things seem to be have been in preparation, or at least there are circumstances existed which made people open to the gospel. Point out that there was an attempt by Augustus to revive the old Roman mythological religion, rebuilding a temple, reestablishing the priesthood. But for the reasons that I gave, it did not really meet the need. Symptomatic of the disenchantment with the people in the first century with this, the old mythological religion was the rise and prosperity of mystery religions. This is our last session talking about the mystery religions. One more thing needs to be said, and then Roman numeral 6, concerning this spiritual vacuum, and that is the state of philosophical thinking. Many Romans, many thinking people, as Romans, had sought an answer to life's riddles on a reason to live in philosophy. I point out that the Romans did not write philosophy, they devised philosophy. And I'm not going to, this is something that we're not committed by time in this class to do a complete discussion of this. By the way, one of the classes you'll probably take future in the history of philosophy, but a little bit more systematically there. But I want to simply say in this class that the Greek philosophy, which the Romans borrowed from other philosophies, became a predominant philosophical view, was Stoicism. And when the gospel went out into the Greek world, it runs into the Stoics. This mentioned anywhere in the Bible. Acts 17, Paul ran into the Stoics on the Areopagus, or being translated as Mars Hill. Now, the Romans adopted Stoicism for a number of reasons, and I'll go into it in a few minutes as we develop this thinking, but I expect you to know this, that the all the princes of Epicureanism never got off the ground. Some of the minor philosophies. Platonism, as a pure philosophy, did not get off the ground, although you see much of Plato in Stoicism. But we have today, it's imperative that we understand something about Stoicism. And it is important to early Christian studies, as well as New Testament studies. But early Christian, I mean from the end of the time period covered by the New Testament and forward. Now, I don't think it's necessary to say too much about the history of Stoicism, because we deal with this in the history of philosophy class. But it came, by the way, you get this term Stoicism, because the early philosophers met in Athens, this was the Greek philosophy, on a painted porch, and a porch that was called a painted porch, and
in Greek, the word stoa is the Greek word for porch. We would call it porch. And the stoa of Hercules means the painted porch. Hence, these philosophers who met on the porch, the philosophers of the porch, are the Stoics. In the Greek word, I said stoa, so you know the etymology of the word. There are many famous Stoics. I would mention, really, one of the founder of Stoicism is generally credited to be Zeno of Cyprus. And just a few minor points in the history of Stoicism. Stoicism was adopted, was favored by the Romans, for a number of reasons. The teaching of the Stoics, their worldview was something like this, that the, the cosmology of Stoicism was something like this, that the world, that all nature runs in cycles. They learned to pick up on this because of the cycle of the seasons, for instance, of the planting and the harvest. Winter, summer, birth, death, sunrise, sunset. And everything seemed to go in circles. And so the Stoics developed the philosophy, or the view that believed that the world went through a series of cycles of being burned up and then being reborn and burned up and being reborn, and that we were in a cycle, of course, of being reborn or of life. But at the end of the world would be in a conflagration, would be fire. And they taught immortality, a limited immortality of the soul. What they taught was that when a man died, if he was a good man, he was sort of in a Buddhist kind of way, he was in a state of bliss temporarily. If a man was evil, he was in a state of punishment temporarily. But when this final conflagration came, ultimately, he would be destroyed. So it was not a full immortality of the soul. It's kind of like you would be tormented until some future time, or be uncomfortable anyway, not tormented, until finally everything would be destroyed. The good and the bad. So finally, and so the important thing to point out here is, this was the emphasis of Stoicism, there was no ultimate victory for righteousness, and there was no eternal punishment for unrighteousness. Ultimately, everything was destroyed, just all over again. For this reason, the church was often accused of borrowing the idea of hell from the Stoics. Simply because it taught them, and Jesus taught that the world would end in fire. It would be the other aspects of Stoicism. This way they stumbled onto one point of truth. Yes.
Well, we had hell way before Stoicism came around, didn't we? In the Bible.
Not explicitly, no, to be honest with you. The Bible says very little, comparatively speaking, about the nature or state of life after death. Comparatively speaking. The Bible is very clear about this life after death. That's where the detail. Comparatively few details. Jesus talks about the other son, but not much. And in the Old Testament, it's not. Yeah, even fewer details in the New Testament. So I would say that the doctrine of hell was implicit in the Old Testament before Stoicism. And that's when you're right, but not explicit. You cannot find an explicit statement of the doctrine of hell in the Old Testament. Neither can you find an explicit statement of the doctrine of heaven. You have the concept of life after death, continuing life. Abraham was gathered to his fathers, idea of life going on. But as to the nature of that life, no explicit detail.
Is the birth and death and rebirth, this type of reincarnation, you come back in different lives?
No, not reincarnation. In other words, the Stoics said ultimately if you died, you were dead. There might be a temporary time when you would be a conscious existence. Mm-hmm. But when the final conflagration came, that was it.
Did they credit all this to God?
Not really. God was, but they did not have a God as such. They believed in a God, and they used the term, but not in a personal God. Their God did not function apart from nature. Now, therefore, in this cycle, you got this? So the ultimate, there was no hope. And they did not talk much about what we would call eternity. They the listen very close to understand Stoicism. Stoicism taught this, that it was a very deterministic system.
What's a deterministic system?
No? What is it? Philosophical history? You say determinism is in a philosophical context. What does it mean? Predestination is a deterministic system. Predetermination. Well, any philosophy or religion, but political philosophy or religious philosophy, that says that there is no ultimate freedom of choice, that what happens to a person is determined by some outside force. You follow me? That ultimately, maybe he makes the minor, he might choose some little, make some itty bitty choices, affect some small things, but ultimately, the fate of a person is determined by something outside that person. That is called a deterministic system. It's the individual, the freedom of choice is ultimately an illusion. There is no freedom of choice, ultimately. And that it's determined. Now, for instance, Calvinism is a deterministic system. Well, what's the determining factor? God, see? If you go to heaven, it's because God determines you to go to heaven. If you go to hell, it's because God determines you to go to hell. Your choice has nothing to do with it. In communism is a deterministic system. What is determining in pure communism? Marxism, what's the determining factor?
Thanks.
Socioeconomic forces. They've been inevitable. The man is caught up in these socioeconomic forces. The class struggle. Inevitable has to happen. An individual cannot choose to make it otherwise. Now, ultimately, he might choose to temporarily. The capitalism, you see, therefore, is an outlaw system. Capitalism is a dying thing. It can never fight. You know, it has to lose. It might win for a while. Ultimately, it has to lose because this is the nature. Evolution, that person has environmental determinism, sometimes keyed upon evolution. The man is simply the product of evolutionary antecedents. Well, it's actually arguing in court. A man kills somebody. This is never simply a vestige of a beast of nature. This is an evolutionary throwback. Therefore, he's not ultimately responsible. And this is actually arguing in court today. And there's a big flat going on now. You know, if man determined by his environment, then who's to blame? And this is the basis of our judicial system now. For instance, if a person comes to court, we do not try the person, we try the environment. Does that make any sense? Why did he do that? Because he chose to do it. Why does it count? Because his parents treat him a certain way, because of the school system, because of the economic situation going on, everything is pretty determined. And there are deterministic systems.
And it's both political or religious.
Well, Stoicism is very much that. Everything is determined by nature. You find in this thought, by the way, is very much the 19th century intellectuals in Europe, especially France, that nature just goes on, and you cannot ultimately fight it. You got there? Therefore, if nature is the highest good, got this? If nature is the only ultimate acting force, then the highest good, in other words, if nature is the highest good and the only good, then the highest human moral good is to go along with nature, to be in harmony with what's going on and not fighting it. The basic ethic, personal ethic of Stoicism is go with the flow. Now, it's a thing of that. You heard the song, In Case the Rouse are Off? It's French. Yeah.
we're not meant to have this, we're not, we're not meant to do this, and anything like that. You know, people believe that. People work on that. They function at that level. You ever heard that? Well, we're going to go ahead and tell this to know that we're not meant to have it. We won't have it. I was talking to a guy last night, and that's the same thing you said. That's the same thing. Well, good or bad, whatever it is, God's will. He said, this is what the people are going to do. They're coming to the people. You know, well, whatever you do, God's will.
They apply that to Judas Iscariot too, and he turned it to you know.
The candle shop. Oh, the candle shop.
What is it that when the person is going today, was the talk about sober person and
not saved?
I'm
not saved. Okay. But anyway, and by the way, the thing that right will be is absolutely 100% meaningless. Of course, right will be. No question about that. The question is, can I affect it? Can I choose what will be? Does it make any difference? Do my choices make any difference concerning what will be? But anyway, so therefore, you got this? Yes.
Why do you think you decide to destroy it?
Well, this, let me explain this to the way things are.
Nope.
See, a good story does not question the way things are. A good story does not ask the question why. He does not try to struggle against this, you see. Everything that happens then, you see, is whatever happens, is the natural order of things. You got this? Whatever happens is the natural order of things. Whether it's good or bad or seen, whether it's helpful or damaging, there's no difference. Mm-hmm. Now, there and whatever stage, this is why, here I said, when I was talking about slavery, I said the slave taught what? The brotherhood of man. It's very interesting. It is not a Christian concept of the brotherhood of man. In other words, we are not like brothers because we have the same creator. What they taught was that, well, this is very interesting logic. You walk down the street and you see the slave, he occupies this position in life. Why does he occupy that position in life? Because he is worse than other men? Or inferior to other men? Or he made bad choices? No. He's there because he happens to be there. Not because he is intrinsically, inherently inferior. And you walk down the street and you see on the other side of the street the wealthy landowner. Why is he a wealthy landowner? Because he is better than other men, because he made superior choices, because he is intrinsically superior? No, he just happens to be. And therefore, since the wealthy landowner is a wealthy landowner only because he just happens to be that, and the slave is a slave because he just happens to be a slave, the landowner, the wealthy landowner, has no grounds for looking down upon the slave. Therefore, if the slave is a good steward, he will never question the fact that he's a slave. He will never try to be anything else. He will not lash out against the system because he's a slave. He will not curse heaven because he's a slave. He will not curse himself or look down on himself because he's a slave. Because he just, why is he a slave? He just happens to be a slave. Therefore, he will go with the flow. Then he will accept it. He will step up a little. And the wealthy man, he will not look down upon the slave because, you know, that man is not below me on the social scale because I'm better or he's worse. Therefore, you have the idea that brotherhood of all men because we're all caught up in the same trap. We're all in the same trap. We're all in the same boat. In fact, that one guy's down the galley rowing and one guy's in the first class cabin sipping champagne, pure cans. Therefore, you have the concept of one should not feel better than the other. I don't know this. They taught the brotherhood of man. Well, remember I said that Christianity taught the brotherhood of man, implicit in the Christian view of the brotherhood of man, so we have the same God. We're all full of the sin. Well, we need more grace of God. Implicit in that was the idea that ultimately, since we are brothers, the slave is the relationship that the institution of slavery would go out of existence. Right? And it did. But implicit in historicism, even though you have this concept of brotherhood of man for the reason that you don't understand this, because we're all equally victims of chance. Implicit in that is the idea that slave will never try to do anything else, and the master will never think of freeing a slave. Right? This man was born for that. That's his place in nature. So he's a natural slave, I'm a natural master. I'll be his master, he'll be my slave, but we're still, I'm not going to look down. I'll be kind to him. Because he's the victim of circumstance, I'll set free.
Well, but you see, for a Christian, he would argue from the brotherhood of man through freedom for the slave. Not only they did, but the story argued from his concept of the brotherhood of man to the system that would insist that the slave remain a slave. It would violate nature to set him free. By the way, this Calvinism had much of this thought. The work ethic came from this kind of deterministic thinking. That is, where you are is what you're with, where God puts you. Therefore, you function honorably where you are. See, before Calvin, in the Middle Ages, if you had to work, that was a sign that you, well, you know, if you were a peasant, you had to actually have to grunt for a living. That was a sign that you were inferior. So under Calvin, that's where God puts you, therefore, you would. It was honorable to function well where God put you. Very close to function.
That's
and if an intellectual and I divide his time to be his master's drunkenness and his lust,
Benjamin is your man, and has peace the boy.
Start again. And never bring the word about your loss. You never,
lose and look at it. You can be a triumph and disaster, and treat those two impostors just the same. That's pure suicide. Great victory, you don't get excited. Great defeat, you don't get excited. You got that? You can meet with triumph and disaster, and treat those two impostors as the same. So forth. Anyway, if you can fill the unforgiving moment there for 60 seconds worth of distance run, then yours is the world, and everything is in it, and which is more, you'll love. You'll be a man, my son.
Oh, man.
I don't want to be a part of that, but just what I'm trying to illustrate to you is that this poem, you've seen it before, it's in greeting cards and things, is a pure modern statement of stoicism. And it comes, you know, it says, be a man. Well, the Romans, who had nothing better, liked this. The second reason they liked it was that that stoicism was a rationale for their rule of the world. Now, that is, on what basis, moral or ethical or philosophical reason should the rest of the world bow down to the Romans?
It's awesome.
Pardon?
It's awesome.
Yeah, that is, you see, the Romans were the natural rulers. You got that? Nature had provided, just like nature provides that some animals are strong and some animals are weak. The strong animals should not be a crowd, the weak animals should not be seen. You got that? Two animals need the water hole. They fight to the death. The natural order of things. Therefore, nature had dictated the natural thing for the Romans to rule, and they should not be too proud. And it was a natural thing for the rest of the world to obey. And they should not resent it. Well, if you're going to rule, if you're going to be in charge anyway, it's not to have a philosophy that makes it. All right. See, that's the same thing in American slavery, by the way. The white man is the natural master. The one who started this kind of thing, he was the British in the 19th century. That, you know, the white man's burden, the white man is born to carry the burden for all the races. I mean, it's interesting, the British used exactly the rationale, the stoic rationale, when they were ruling over a world of non-whites, non-Anglo-Saxons, but the Romans did. Exactly the same. The white man's burden. In this case, God ordained them to put everybody's life in order. And they did put it in order pretty much.
There's no railroads and schools and also just hospitals.
And a lot of good came out, but I'm not here to defend that idea. Somebody's saying this was the rationale behind it. We are destined, you know. One race is a natural, you know, the black man, he's born to take second place, and the white man's born to take first place. This is apartheid, say, in South Africa now. This is the philosophy behind it. In Rhodesia. Got that? Because of the natural, this is the way, it's the natural world, whether you put God in or not. You see why the Romans were like this? It gave it philosophical, it lent what we would consider to be a pseudo-philosophical justification for what they were going to do anyway. See, if they're going to do something anyway, it's nice to do it in the name of God or philosophy or truth. People do what they want to do. And they try to find some reason to respect it. And, it's human nature. Well, do you see why the Romans would adopt Stoicism? It was on a personal basis. It was this manly, and it was a philosophy of strong man. On a universal basis, it meant a justification for their rule over other peoples, their enslavement of other peoples. Let's not say Rome was a Stoic. Simply saying, this helps us to understand why, among other philosophies, that Stoicism was one of the more popular philosophies. Now, let me read what I started to read before. This is from Seneca. What is this principle of thing in human life? To raise the soul above the threats and promises of fortune, to consider nothing is worth hoping for. What is the principal thing? To be able to endure adversity with a joyful heart. To bear whatever betide you just as if it were the very thing you desire to have happen to you. Your baby, you get up one morning, your little 4-year-old son, the apple of your eye, find him dead. What do? Well, you act as if that's what you wanted all along. You accept it with perfect equanimity. For you would have felt it your duty to desire had you known that all things happen by divine decree. So you do not separate God from nature. That is, I didn't plan on this, but if I had known it, that's the way things are going to be, that's the way I would have planned it. to go with the flow. What's the principal thing? Well, you would have felt like you needed to start, and had you known that all things happen by divine decree. Tears, complaints, lamentations are rebellion against divine order. If you cry when your baby dies, your wife dies, your husband dies, you're rebelling against the divine order. It's not natural. Was natural, what happened? Yes. Some people see more stoicism than preach at a funeral. A well-made nigger boots. As a preacher, possibly, but I've been a priest of Lambert, a mate, and I've lived there for 35 or 40 years, and the person dies. First thing they say is, God took him. God, I used to like to say at a funeral. The first thing they understand is that God is the chief mourner at every funeral, not the murderer. Why did he die? Because his sister sinned and didn't die because God took him. God's not a murderer, not an assassin. Then the loved one is expected to bear up well. Why isn't she doing well? What does that mean? We still kind of get to explain this, but the death was an act of God. Therefore, if you cry too much, then you're really doubting God. Now, the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. That's why we cry. It's a lot of misery. So what do they do? He's nervous right now. They take pills. You can cry and try to go around and agree with the rest. Sure, theology. The Bible called, you know, and we ought to handle death. Don't be a stoic, be a Christian. No. A lover will die. Sit down with that person and say, look, God is the chief of them. God, in other words, this is terrible. Of course it's terrible. God says that everybody dies. The Bible calls death the last enemy. When anybody dies, a terrible thing has happened. Don't act like something good has happened. Something bad has happened. You know, something bad happens, that's what I try about. We stiff upper lip. God isn't, it's not a religious act to hold your tears in and love to die. Because God took him, I don't want to doubt God. That's what is silly. That's good stoicism, you see. It's not Christian. Y'all get my point? It's not rebellion against nature. And, some of your greatest opportunities are to counsel people when a loved one dies. Great opportunity to minister to people. Let me give you a golden rule. The less you say, the better. Usually, that's the expectation for a young preacher, especially say too much. Don't try to explain it. Why? Why did God take me? Why did God take me? Well, because he's a little boy. Counsel of life, and father died. Well, Jesus died. That stupid man said, not good, curse, but. The boys of father said, they're thinking, well, Jesus didn't need somebody to take him camping, and I do. Chris and I say, yes, that kind of counsel. So they said, terrible that God regrets it, God hates it, he gave his son, both kind of regrets of death. And the best thing you can do is somebody just sit down and weep with him. I'll try to explain that. Because, in a simple point, all you can do is point out, just things are going to go further on. Ultimately, God will make things right. God will make things right. We have to start the last thing to do the resurrection of us. But right now, this is a terrible tragedy. God knows it is, and I know it is, and you know it is, unless we can forget it. Don't be a stoic, see it.
The thing that came to my mind was the book of Job, because some of the things that I've read about it, and ideas that were expressed about, that was this one book that Reed gave me. Kind of expresses that was kind of his opinion of everything. The Lord gives, the Lord takes away, the brings in the name of the Lord. That sort of thing.
Well, that does not take the Bible in total context on the teaching on death. It does not teach that the silly death of a person is an act of God. What is the principal thing? The heart in the face of calamity. Listen to this. What is the principal thing? What's the highest good? A heart in the face of calamity. Keep heart. Don't lose heart. Resolute and invincible. An adversary, yea, a sworn foe of the lecture. Maybe Christian Science, better. Neither anxious to meet nor anxious to shun peril. The heart that knows how to fashion fortune to its will without waiting for it. Which shall go forth to face ill or good, dauntless and unembarrassed. Paralyzed neither by the tumult of the one nor the glamour of the other. What is the principal thing? Not to admit evil counsel to the heart. Lift up clean hands to heaven.
to seek for no advantage that someone must give and someone lose in order that they may reach you. To pray a prayer that no one will oppose, for the purity of heart. And they had a high ethic, by the way. But you did not. Lived a stern moral life. The Stoics had a very high ethic. Very close to the Jewish and the Christian. Very close to the Judeo-Christian ethic. What is the principal thing I'm excerpting now? To lift one's courage high above all that depends on chance. Remember what man is, so that whether you may be fortunate, you may know that it is that this will not be for long. Whether you may be unfortunate, you may be sure you are not so. You do not think yourself so. Worst thing that happened to you, I'm bad luck. Only if you say so. What is the principal thing? To have life in the very lips, ready to issue when summoned. Ah, now we're getting on the last point. I don't know what that next week. Is that if death is the quote natural thing, the ultimate thing, then the ultimate expression of Stoicism was to face death unflinchingly. And in fact, in Stoicism, and we're going to have to deal with this because that's tomorrow. In Stoicism, the ultimate expression of pure Stoic was his perfect willingness at any time to take his own life.
But he can do it. Wouldn't that interfere with the divine force of nature?
Good question. The answer is that if he did it,
They would believe in it, quote, but that they would not really
didn't hang their heart on it. You see, this old axiom that you know, a religion is not worth living for, it's not worth dying for. You might believe in the old God, but you don't give your life for it. Because the whole thing is kind of empty anyway. And so, there's no real hope. Not eternal hope. So, Stoicism became a very popular philosophy because, and for a number of reasons, one of which is that it sort of gave you a reason to have a stiff upper lip in the face of the absence of hope. You know, to face life courageously, even though there was no ultimate hope. Now, this is the kind of thing existentialism has done in the 60s, late 50s and 60s, but really became popular in the early 60s. And there was a mood of a turning away from biblical faith in America. It was the post-war period. War is always demoralizing. The Second World War was exceedingly demoralizing. And created a great deal of skepticism concerning religious faith, traditional biblical faith, evangelical faith, conservative faith. So there was a turn away from God, as it were. And when you turn away from God, you face the prospect of a universe without ultimate hope. It's going anywhere. That's one of the problems that evolutionists have. In other words, if we are here by total, if we are here only by the chance, only by the, as the result of a process of total chance organic evolution, that is, we are only here because we happen to be here, then we are only going where we happen to be going, and our life only means what we happen to want it to mean at this particular point in time. There's no overriding, ultimate, absolute, external hope. Therefore, existentialism became very, very popular in the 50s and 60s because it took some old, the ideas of an old theology of Sheeran and Kierkegaard, of course, and said, in effect, well, even though there's no hope out there, the only alternative is suicide. Therefore, we don't want to commit suicide. Therefore, we will build a hope in here. In other words, whether it's ultimately, absolutely, externally true or not doesn't count as long as it's internally true, as long as it's true to me. As Kierkegaard said, I want truth that is true for me. Therefore, the significance of the moment, of what you believe, is only that which you impose upon it. You decide to have it. In other words, my life, in other words, it's called the... You get a term like authentication. When you act in a positive way, you authenticate yourself. You authenticate the moment. You tell me, because you have consciousness, freely will to do something, therefore you have authenticated your existence in this moment. And therefore that's the meaning this moment has. And the only meaning it has. But you see, in the name of you sort of have a stiff upper lip to face this hopeless universe courageously. I'm making sense to you. Well, you know, it's sort of imposed. We'll get here from the statistical philosophy, but what I'm trying to show you is the parallel between our day and that day. Now, the Stoicism was not existentialism, but they, in this area, they furnished the same meager comfort. And this sort of leap of faith, you know, you choose to believe, not because you're forced to believe, not because it's logical or reasonable, ultimately. Sinful to believe because you want to believe. And of course, the ultimate act of, but the problem with that is it's all moral, existentialist philosophy, because the man goes out into the jungles like Schweitzer and builds a hospital and cares for the lepers. That's an act of self authentication. He authenticates himself by this positive act. As if, you know, he does a meaningful thing. The only meaning is the meaning he himself imposes into it, imposes upon him, that comes with. One problem with that is the man who did not shoot his mother in law in the eyes of the shotgun is also authenticating himself in a meaningful way. Well, of course, they would back off now, but that's. And of course, the ultimate existential experience is the experience when you have a complete, you project yourself into a completely non national state and do something completely non national. And then if that happens, you can't explain it because it's non national. Anyway, one professor said, in some lecture on existentialism, he says, now, when I finish this series of lectures, you're going to want to go out and kill yourself. He said, you must not do that because you can't be sure that that is the ultimate act of self-authentication.
case it probably is, I can't be sure. For some reason, those who've done it have been opposed. Well, this all sounds pretty abstract. It's still a case of judgment, really. Well, either there's God or isn't God, either the heaven or the hell or isn't, and you're like me, and he doesn't. But you see, we can say that because we believe. And have you ever done business with intellectual, sensitive, bright, honest people? You don't have any faith. You can see it very, very seriously. Well, anyway, the absolute Baltimore Stoicism sort of gave a philosophical reason for keeping on, for being ethical and moral. It wasn't kind of thing, what it was, but even anything else. Any old port in time and so on, as they say. Now, so Seneca writes on death. He says, born for a very brief space of time, we regard this life as an end, which we are soon to quit, that it may be made ready for the coming guest. Check out time 11:30. Because here we are in this life, and we're going to check out, and somebody else can check in. That's the way you look at it. We got our time in the room. We can get our time in life. Somebody else. Do I speak of our lives, which we know roll away incredibly fast? I'm dead. What does the Bible say? James, what do you say? Life like a vapor, it's here today, and it vanishes away. Reckon up the centuries of cities, you will find that even those which boast of their antiquity have not existed for long. You know, the old cities. There's a tour group from Syria was being taken on a guided tour through Boston. And the tour guide looked at one of the cities, one of the buildings, and said, can you believe that this building is 200 years old? And one of the tour guides said, well, I can maybe get back to Damascus and tell about that. But anyway, even those who have this existed for a long time, all human works are brief and fleeting. They take up no part, whatever, of infinite time. Is that true? Really, yeah. It's true. Look at a man's lifetime. Even an old city, look at Rome. When you figure the infinity of time, then watch a couple of centuries or a couple hundred years or a couple of days. Tried by the standard of the universe, we regard this earth of ours, with all its cities, nations, rivers, and seaboards, as a mere point. Our life occupies less than a point when compared with all time, the measure of which exceeds that of our world, for indeed the world is contained many times in it. Of what importance, then, can it be to lengthen that which, however much you add to it, will never be much more than nothing? I'll read that again. What importance then can it be to lengthen that which, however much you add to it, will never be much more than nothing? Say, man, he gets to be 50. And then he really gets concerned. He starts on yogurt and starts getting made for things once a year. Why? Because he wants to live to be 75. He's supposed to die 25 years. What real difference does it make? When it can never be much more than nothing. Is that true?
Against the universe?
Yeah, true. That's true. As far as time is concerned, that's true. If this life is all there is, then that's true. And, you know, there's a man who, in a way, see, Stoicism said a lot of smart things. For instance, I would agree with the Stoic, and he would say something like this. Well, you get a man whose life does nothing, right? He's not doing anything good. He's occupying space. His whole life consists of, he comes home from work, and he sits in front of the TV and drinks beer. You know, and does he elevate society? No, he's ignorant. Once he's read the sports page, you know, that's all he cares about. His social consciousness consists of telling racial jokes. Did you ever write a great book? No. Did you ever help somebody? Not really. The his overriding concern is for himself. What difference does it make whether he dies at the age of 30 or at the age of 70? Well, sure, he could say that. But of course, the problem with that is they would say something about a good man. A man who wrote great books, found a cure for cancer. Ultimately, it would not make a whole lot of difference. We can only make our lives long by one expedient, that is, by being satisfied with their length. Now, Jesus said, can you by worrying about it add an inch to your stature, does anxiety make you live longer? He said, the only way you can live as you length of your life is to be satisfied with how long it is. What do you mean by that? The only way you can make your life longer is to be satisfied with whatever length you have.
Do the most of what time you do.
Appreciate what you have, that you don't, because in other words, a Stoic would say, why worry about death? Because death is going to come, there's no hope. And, but you do have today. You can be a gentleman today, you can enjoy it today, you can smell the flowers, you can listen to your John Denver records. You can love your wife, play with your kids, enjoy good wine, you can read a good book. Today. But you see, if you spend today, or any part of today, worrying about death, then you've lost that day. Therefore, by not worrying about death, you gain the day. Therefore, that's what he meant was, but only by not worrying about death can you make your life any longer. That is, by not trying to, if you worry about how long your life is, then you make it shorter. Is that true? Anyway, we'd want to say much more than that, wouldn't we? As we've said that, but that in and of itself is true. You may tell me of long-lived men whose length of days has been celebrated by tradition. You may assign 110 years apiece to them. Yet when you allow your mind to conceive the idea of eternity, there will be no difference between the shortest and the longest life. If you compare the time during which anyone has been alive with that during which he has not been alive, in the next place, when he died, his life was complete. He had lived as long as he needed to live. There was nothing left for him to accomplish. That's why the Stoic, you see, when he was no longer able to appreciate his days, then the logical step was what?
Suicide,
you see. And that was long enough. You see, suppose, in other words, man, he's not enjoying himself anymore. Maybe he's sick. Oh, this argument is used for those who would push a form of euthanasia today. It's also used, by the way, the basic argument for abortion is stoicism. Did you know that? Pagan stoicism, pro-abortion, which says this, that life is valuable only if it's enjoyed. Therefore, if a person, if they are so sick that life is a terrible burden to them, then you do them a favor by pulling the plug. Or, if this baby, if it were allowed to come to full term and be born, if it would not enjoy life, not wanted, would not be properly fed, would not be educated, or it would cause its mother or somebody else to enjoy life less, then you terminate its life early. And then by that expediency, you don't want any unenjoyable lives running around. Just, burdening the landscape. You all see that? Isn't that the basic argument?
Yeah, sure.
For abortion? This life will not be productive, fruitful, or somebody else's life will not be productive, fruitful because of this. Therefore, kill the child. It is a child, of course. And by the way, I think that, I'm speaking from whatever I am of a historian. A historian is supposed to look at the long view of things, look at culture, of cultures, these patterns developing. And if I know what I think I know, American culture, America is very much gone. And I think one of the indications that America is gone, and by America we mean not just the country, but the ideal, that is gone, is because America, by and large, has accepted abortion. They say, we object to it. But there's no genuine universal indignation that would, lead the marchers to the streets, to burn the abortion mill. We've got to either write letters to our congressmen. We're very civilized, We write letters to our congressmen, or we sign petitions. That's about it. We hate it. We object. But you see, we passed Hitler up, by the way. Abortion, we kill more than he had now. We kill more babies than he killed Jews. And yet, you see, if we accept this stoic, we apply. By the way, did you know that one of the big things the church was known for in the beginning was it was against abortion? See, abortion was an old practice, Roman practice, so why would it? They had a method, they also practiced another method, means to the same end. It was not called abortion, but they practiced abortion. It was called exposure of any unwanted child, often girls, that the child was defective. It was unwanted for any reason, simply they got the city dump or somewhere from a point of place and left it. They died. It's called exposure, but old practice. Now, if anybody wanted a child, might go get it. Wanted children, people would get them. But the story of Cyrus, the great Persian king, had been left and exposed. Somebody shepherd and God raised him. It may be true, I don't know. But the point is, by the way, that's a. I mean, if you're going to practice abortion, what y'all do? Why endanger the life of the mother? Wait till the kid's born, then kill her. You could give it an overdose of ether or something, give it pain. I think if you take a 1 hour old baby who is simply given an injection or something, it makes it go to sleep and never wake up, suffers less pain than a 6 week old fetus. Or it has developed nervous system. You simply scrape out of the tool. That's more humane than the baby born. Just give a shot at something. It's safer for the mother. But you see, then you can let, then you have to look in the eye. And nobody wants to do it. But my point is that this may be a valuable lesson of history. But our culture is gone because of what we tolerate. It's paganism. The only value of a life is if it's acceptable, enjoyable, by our terms. And you see the problem you have. This is why it leads to this kind of thinking. And this is the thing that the American liberal press has never been able to see. Absolutely. Naive is that you see the problem that you got is this is the basis of it. This is my lecture on this. The fundamental basic philosophical problem you have this. As soon as I decide that your life in and of itself has no ultimate value, I'll make that decision. You got that? In other words, or any other. As soon as I make the decision that a life has no ultimate value. In and of itself, and therefore it does not have to be preserved if it's not convenient for us or for it. As soon as I make that decision about you, then the same thing true becomes true about my life. As soon as I decide that you are of no ultimate, eternal, intrinsic value, then the same thing becomes true of me. Doesn't it? That's the basic problem, you see. The same crowd that's for pro-abortion is also, generally speaking, anti-capital punishment. That's when you can't take a hardened criminal who, by due process of law, careful evaluation, the objectivity of the judicial system, cannot decide his life can go. But you can take the life of an unborn baby without even hearing. He's guilty. Absolute innocence. In other words, you must preserve life no matter how guilty, as long as they're born. But you can take life no matter how innocent before it's born. You show me the logic of that. Well, anyway, so I want to see it. Stoicism, you see. So the Stoics would be very much for abortion, or euthanasia, or suicide. Why? because you see, life has no ultimate value. Therefore, as soon as it ceases to be convenient, expedient, enjoyable, fruitful, appreciated, then you must make an end of it.
I've heard a lot of you know about America heading toward downfall, and I was wondering if by you know studying what you study, tax cultures and nations, and all I mean, you know, say that America is gone already. What do you?
What's already gone?
You know, can you predict anything for the future? Not predict. And, I mean, can you follow a certain trend in cultures? Do they all follow kind of the same trend?
Yeah. Disintegration, but I don't know what happens. I don't know what's going to happen. But America is, as we think of America, the value of the individual, representative government, and all this has been gone for 15 years. Because what we are is a socialist welfare state with a pagan philosophy. And we have been for a long time. I'm for taking under God out of our pledge of allegiance, not because I don't believe it ought to be under God. I think America ought to be under God. But every time we pledge allegiance to a country under God, we're lying. It's been a long time since we were under God. And you see, and you look at this corruption in high places, that's just a symptom of it. That's just the surface. I said before, you know, there are symptoms, for instance, we don't expect, in other words, we accept, as a nation, we accept abortion. And I said before, I think, in another context, we don't even expect our leaders to tell the truth anymore. You know, the president gets on the radio, there's no more television, there's no connection between what he says and reality. We don't expect it to be. But you find political language, jargon, we... And so he, for instance, you see, there's a, yes, I'm sorry, I didn't pass it, ignore
you. How are they defined to us by the way it's supposed to be determined in
life? Yes, it is, life has no, the length of life has nothing whatever to do with it. In other words, if life, you see, this is true, by the way, Tom. If life, if there's no life after death, in a meaningful way, you see, if there's no God, no judgment, no heaven, no hell, then
they're destructive. They're a very life.
Now, the length of life has nothing whatever to do with the value of life. Therefore, you see, when you quit getting your kick and cut your kicks, you kill yourself.
That's what I was asking. It's on a kind of a system of determination, a deterministic system of what was supposed to happen.
Yes. It's sort of natural thing. It's natural for you to live. But if you get up one morning and say, I've done it all. I think when, I almost, you know, George Burns, an article on George Burns, the paper's from, going to have his 100th birthday, but he's scheduled on the Palladium, he's only 88 or 85 or something, but he's scheduled on the Palladium on his 100th birthday, so he's going to be out of town, he's having the birthday party now. And anyway, he's decided not to die. He's been done. And he's looking for another exit. No, he won't find one. But that's a good story.
You see, I think our good stories are a lot of people that have it as well, because they live, you know, all life, get all they can out of it, and end up in a big bunch of people, because they're fighting, quote unquote, something on people.
Yeah, right. Right, and they're right. It's a logical thing.
They're going to hold the population down.
As I'm kind of getting ahead of myself here, see, the one thing that really startled the Stoic is this. It's appointed to men once to die. That gives no problem. But after this, just you accept the latter half, and you the whole result.
When you were talking before, abortion and the taking life and valuable enjoy, now you're talking about the baby would not be valuable because it's not enjoyable to the people. Will they also apply it like that the baby is not have a chance to enjoy life yet, so it's not valuable to itself?
Well, they would say the baby doesn't count and doesn't know anything. And a person, the whole person doesn't count, actually don't know anything. Well,
I hate to be young or old.
The problem with that is you can look at babies, you might have been better off if they hadn't been born, by our standards. So we say, well, this child looks so very retarded that the virgin itself, the virgin is better off than born. The problem with that is, if you start making decisions like that, then the big question comes, who's going to decide? If I give a man the right by my vote to decide if that baby can live or not, what I really done is give him the right to decide if I can live or not. See, the problem is you can't have it both ways. And that's all Hitler did, you see. Once you make that decision, then everything else follows. So he decided, in other words, you got this diseased child, and you get rid of it. Amen. You got this diseased race, the Jews, get rid of them. Amen. No difference. So once you make that decision, once you turn that corner.
Well, then you start getting into this mercy killing situation about pulling plugs on life support systems and all that.
Well, again, it's not the same. There's a difference between euthanasia and not resorting to heroic measures to preserve life. There's a difference, you see, between simply not creating artificial life by machine when a person is, quote, dead or dying, probably. That's not the same thing as getting an old person who's living on and on and on, you have to feed them, and giving them a shot of something to kill them. I think there's a definite difference. So you say, well, it's a slim thread. Yeah, I think it is, but you see, you got what I'm saying? To artificially extend life by heroic medical measures is not the same thing as finally going to the old people, see, and the ones who aren't productive anymore or simply who sleep all day and slobber on themselves and some other involved in things to see getting her a shot to leave her to sleep forever. It's not the same thing at all. In other words, because if one person comes in who's finally who's dead, unless you hook them up to the machine, the machines live for them. That's not euthanasia. The refusal to do that. Yeah, any of you?
I heard something last week, somebody said something about this guy, I think in Sweden or something, that did that type of thing. He worked in a nursing home, and he said he felt sorry for all the old people, so he was getting employed and kind of killed so much money.
Oh, yeah. The problem with that is, you say, well, that's okay. Okay. But what about you get some intellectual totalitarian genius who feels sorry for us because we're Christians?
That's it.
You see, once you make a decision, like this pagan, stoic decision, then you got to live with it.
If you follow that same sort of stoic idea in that same situation with a child that's going to cause an unpleasant situation, doesn't it follow the same logic to have the child be born and kill the mother? Does that remove the unpleasant situation also?
Yeah, might as well. That'd be fair anyway, but the child be born with a point. The mother doesn't want the kid. The kid wants to live. The mother wants to enjoy life. The kid potentially wants to enjoy life. You know, we can assume that because it's life. It's instinct for survival, they're gonna call it. Might as well. Anyway, now let me read Nero. I think this is funny. Nero was probably this thing of suicide. Now Nero was not a good story. Nero was crazier than a bedbug. But it's interesting. I think it's kind of ironic. We're not going to get through this, but you thought your quiz would probably be dead for tomorrow.